WNBC, one of America's great pioneer radio stations, presents The Billion Dollar Show. On records and transcriptions, we'll hear Bob and Ray, Fred Allen, Nick Kenny, the Jesters, and many memories of radio favorites of the past. On August 28, 1922, just 30 years ago today. If you were listening to your radio here in New York, chances are you were tuned to station WEAF, which is now station WNBC. And you may have heard Vincent Lopez playing one of radio's first theme songs.
Hello, everybody. Lopez speaking.
Then, as you sat entranced with the earphones over your ears, you may have heard radio's first sweethearted song, Vaughn DeLeese.
I'm listening, and I listen to them croon. There's two lonesome people in the whole wide world. That's me and the man in the moon.
As you fiddled with the cat's whisker on your crystal set, you may have heard Billy Jones and Ernie Hare, the Happiness Boys.
Just feel great, you just left. I tore up her photograph. She'll never find a fella like me.
And on that day, just 30 years ago, you may have heard an announcement that made radio history.
Friends, you owe it to yourself and your family to leave the congested city and enjoy what nature intended you to enjoy. Visit our new apartment homes in Hawthorne Court, Jackson Heights, where you may enjoy community life in a friendly environment.
That was radio's first commercial announcement, heard over WEAF on August 28, 1922, just 30 years ago today. Since then, radio sponsors have spent more than $1 billion each year to bring you entertainment, news, and public service features. As we observe this 30th anniversary of commercial broadcasting, we're going to recall a few memories of the days when radio was new. Through our American system of broadcasting, you've received endless hours of entertainment. And you've received endless hours of...
I'm Bob.
And I'm Ray.
Endless hours of Bob Elliott and Ray Goulding.
Oh, they just seem like endless hours.
And seriously, we're very happy to be in the radio medium.
Yes, we certainly are happy to be in this medium.
Yes, it is. It's a happy medium.
But seriously, friends, have you ever thought of the importance of advertising?
Now, think of all the fine products, the better living, all the opportunities, of all the improvements that have been brought to your attention through advertising.
Why, advertising can change your life, open up a new career, give you chances for success you never dreamed of.
For instance, listen to this.
Listen, listen, listen. The most sensational offer of a lifetime.
The Bob and Ray Getaway Car.
A must for everyone who's ever had to make a fast getaway.
The Bob and Ray Getaway Car is the answer to bill collectors, motorcycle cops, the Treasury Department, and Brinks.
Perfected in the Bob and Ray laboratories over a period of 12 years and 38 daylight robberies, the getaway car is the last word in speed, comfort, and safety.
Now at last, every man can be a millionaire. The getaway car lets you carry out every crime from a holdup with simple assault to a big job on the First National with absolute ease and assurance.
And here's what makes the Bob and Ray getaway car the biggest boon to organized crime since the invention of the blackjack. The entire car is made of steel.
That's S-T-E-A-L, steel.
Windows are made of glass 6 inches thick and are guaranteed bulletproof, acid-proof, and bomb-proof.
Of course, this makes it impossible for you to see through the windows, but we've taken care of that. For you drive by radar.
A 20-millimeter automatic rifle is mounted neatly beside the driver, right below the Kleenex dispenser.
It's the only car with an automatic summons rejector. Park wherever you like. Next to a fire hydrant, in the middle of a highway, anywhere you like. As soon as a summons is attached to your windshield wiper, the car rejects it,
forcibly throwing the policeman from his motorcycle. Bob and Ray Getaway Car offers you the widest choice in attractive upholstery.
Yeah, you can have gay plaid stripes, steel on concrete, or attractive cast iron in solid colors.
And when it comes to speed, you can't beat this car.
No car on the road can beat it. The Getaway Car attains a speed of 250 miles an hour easily. And you can't be traced, because with every single car, we provide you with the license plates of some dear friend.
The back seat of the car is divided into neat compartments for cash. Plenty of room to stash those tens, twenties, fifties, and C-notes.
And you'll still have room for baby, too.
Well, we think the Bob and Ray Getaway car is the perfect car for pleasure and profit. And if you order right now, you'll also get absolutely free 100 gallons of gas.
That's poison gas.
And a complete set of hot tires.
500 pounds of ammunition.
2 tickets to the policeman's ball.
A collection of fingerprints that you can use when pulling a job.
All yours free if you order your Bob and Ray Getaway car right now. And here's the most spectacular part of this offer.
Send for your car. Use it for 24 hours. Have fun with it. Hold up the man in the street. Pull a stick up at your favorite bank. Taunt pedestrians. Violate the traffic rules.
Then, if at the end of 24 hours you're still on the loose, we know you want to keep the car. So keep driving and send us the first payment of $100. An hour later, send the second payment of $100 and keep sending in a payment every hour until the car is paid for. And don't stop driving. Just send your money or anybody else's in a mailbox as you whiz by.
Now, if you're interested in owning the Bob and Ray Getaway car, send a postcard now with your name and address to Getaway NBC, New York.
Where were you on August 28th, 1922, the day modern broadcasting began over station WNBC?
Well, I'm going to ask that question now of a veteran newspaper man who has become a favorite columnist of the New York Daily Mirror, Nick Kenny. Nick, where were you on August 28th, 1922?
Well, I was on the Bayonne Times in Bayonne, New Jersey, writing a column, and I think it was one of the first radio columns because we had a ham named Paul Wandelt, who had a wonderful broadcasting transmitter in his cellar down there in Bayonne. And we used to broadcast every night to the confusion of any few people that listened in on the crystal sets. I was writing songs even then, you know. The first one I wrote was in 1922, and it was called I Met Mary on the Merry-Go-Round. I remember a couple of lines of it. My brother Charlie and I wrote it. I met Mary on the merry-go-round, and we go around together now. Hey! Ah, those were the exciting days back there when we were all a little bit younger. Mm-mm. The memories of those fabulous 1920s keep coming back like a song. Remember this one?
Every morning, every evening, ain't we got fun? Not much money, oh, but honey, ain't we got fun? There's nothing surer, the rich get rich and...
Well, that's one of the songs they were singing back in the days when sheiks and flappers kept heavy dates at the corner sugar bowl. And as a drugstore cowboy, I cut quite a figure in my plus fours and jazz bow tie. And just to show I was a man of the world, I occasionally flashed the package's 10 cents. The life of the party was the guy who played a snappy ukulele so folks could sing songs like this.
Ma, he's making eyes at me. Ma, he's awful nice to me. Ma, he's almost breaking my heart. I'm beside him. Mercy, let his conscience guide him.
Along Broadway in those days, the theater lights flashed the names of Marilyn Miller in Sally, George M. Cohan in The Tavern, Gene Eagles in Rain, Fred Stone in Tip Top, and Ann Pennington in George White's Scandal. A new kind of music called jazz echoed from the Broadway dance halls. And everywhere you went, you could hear...
Barney Google, with his Google googly eyes. Barney Google, had a wife 3 times his size. She sued Barney for divorce, now he's living with his horse. Barney Google, with his Google googly eyes.
If you were taking your sugar to the movies in those days, you saw Lillian Gish in Orphans of the Storm, Harold Lloyd in Grandma's Boy, Rudolph Valentino in Blood and Sand, Richard Barthelmess in Tolerable David, and Norma Talmadge in Smiling Through.
Folks discovered new stars like Whispering Jack Smith, the Silver Masked Tenor, and Wendell Hall, the old red-headed music maker.
Goodbye. Don't cry. The choo-choo train that takes me away from you, no words can tell how sad it makes me. Kiss me, tootsie, and then do it over again. Watch for the mail, I'll never fail. If you don't get a letter, then you'll know I'm in jail. Tut, tut, tootsie, don't cry. Tut, tut, tootsie, goodbye.
sir. Those must have been the days, Ray, huh? Mm-hmm. It'd be dandy to have a car with message inscribed Peaches, here's your can.
Well, it just so happens, Bob, that your Marmon Super 8 still has Peaches, here's your can, emblazoned on it.
That's right. But be that as it may, do you think it's time now to pause for a message?
Were you expecting a message, Bob?
Well, in radio, who doesn't? Everybody's always making a brief pause for a message from. Besides, look at this quaint character approaching in a Wells Fargo uniform.
Do you have a message, boy?
Do I have a message? I certainly do.
Well, look who it is. Fred Allen.
Ladies and gentlemen, at ceremonial affairs of this sort, you only hear about the celebrities, the big people who did the big things. Tonight, we have heard the names of the mighty executives who have operated the station and the various talented stars WEAF has developed and brought to you down through the years. But what about the little people? The people who have made it possible for station WEAF to survive. You know, it's always the little man who makes the big thing possible. After the Holland Tunnel was completed, the first man to venture through the tunnel was a little man whose name has long since been forgotten. But if this courageous little fellow had not proved to the public that the tunnel was safe, and that passing through it, the worst that could happen to a New Yorker would be that he'd find himself in Jersey, the sunken highway would have been a failure. The builders of the Holland Tunnel wouldn't have known their enterprise from a hole in the ground. And so... so it is with WEAF. If the first little man had not listened to station WEAF and told his friends that the air was fraught with music, news, and entertainment, the work of the mighty executives and the various talented stars would have been in vain. Station WEAF might have gone on broadcasting 18 hours a day without a solitary listener. Has the name of WEAF's first listener been mentioned here tonight? No. He was only a little man. He died unwept, unhonored, and apart from an impromptu trio, unsung. But I am here tonight to pay him tribute and to tell you how he was responsible for the success of this great radio station. Now, the first man to hear station WEAF outside of the building that housed its facilities was a Mr. Gaffney Spratt. Mr. Spratt was an old French horn virtuoso who had lost his lip. Unable to play his French horn, Mr. Spratt eked out a meager living demonstrating bubble gum at kindergarten playground. One night as he trudged home after a hard day inflating his chicle globules, Mr. Spratt heard talking going on in his mouth. Since he himself wasn't speaking at the time, Mr. Spratt could not account for the voices. He seemed to be talking with a southern dialect. He thought he was haunted. After 15 minutes of babble, the voices stopped abruptly, and Mr. Spratt's mouth was restored to quiet. The next night, he heard the voices again. Every night, it was the same routine. Every night, promptly at 7 o'clock, Mr. Spratt's mouth was filled with conversation. Every night, the voices were those of the same two southern characters. Abruptly, at 7:15, the voices would stop. Mr. Spratt didn't know it at the time, but he was getting Amos and Andy over WEAF on his bridge work. During the weeks that followed, Mr. Spratt's mouth was filled with music. When Guy Lombardo's band played its soothing melodies, Mr. Spratt would sit down and fall asleep in the nearest doorway. When B.A. Rolfe's brassy syncopation came on, Mr. Spratt's bridge work would rattle, and his head would bob up and down in his derby. With music, news flashes, and comedy programs cascading in an endless flow from his mouth, Mr. Spratt was soon the life of every party. People would invite him out, wine him and dine him, and after dinner, Mr. Spratt would lean back, open his mouth, and the music of the A&P Gypsies or Wayne King would be heard. The guests would roll back the rugs and dance until all out. Now, Mr. Spratt couldn't account for the miracle until Ripley mentioned his name in a believe-it-or-not column. Professor Einstein saw Ripley's cartoon and wrote to Mr. Spratt, explaining radio waves and telling him that he was merely receiving the programs of some radio station on his removable bridge. Mr. Spratt checked and found that the radio station was WEAF. He told his friends that they, too, could get this free entertainment on their bridge work. Those who had no teeth had little wooden boxes made. In the boxes, they placed duplicates of Mr. Spratt's teeth and dental work, which their dentist had copied. And because of the teeth they contained, these first radio-receiving contractions were called sets. So, you see, if it wasn't for a little man, Gaffney Spratt, its first listener, WEAF, might never have been heard of.
Well, kiddies, that's the way it all began, and thank you, Fred Allen. Right now, we want you to meet a man who was on the scene when radio first started.
And that man today is the chief of announcers of the National Broadcasting Company, Mr. Pat Kelly.
Pat, you remember when Ray and I auditioned for you as announcers? I can remember that day just as if it were yesterday, you know. Fact remains, though, that Pat Kelly has been around practically since modern broadcasting began. So how about telling us about the old days, Pat, off the record?
Off the record is right, Bob. Because I have a few records here I think you'll enjoy remembering. You know, at first, radio just seemed like a toy. It was pretty much a bit of, a sort of a hit-or-miss affair. But when commercial broadcasting began, the big shows and the big stars began to come along. There was Louis Katzman and the Anglo-Persians, Gus Henschen and the Champion Sparklers, B.A. Rolfe and the Lucky Strike Dance Band, and see if you remember this.
Harry Reaser and the Crickle Club Eskimos, one of the first great radio orchestras. Maybe you heard them on headphones you had to trade with other listeners. No, they don't sound like Benny Goodman, but it was quite a band.
Those were great days. One new program after another coming along. The Goodrich Silvertown Orchestra, the Atwater Kent Hour, the Contented Hour, Carnation Milk, the Palm Olive Show with Paul Oliver and Olive Palmer, and the City Service Concerts. But of all the unforgettable voices of those early days, one personality stands out in my memory. Here he is at the Navy Yard in Washington in 1927. Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy, was just returning from his history-making flight across the Atlantic.
Ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience, this is Graham Agnew speaking from the Navy Yard, Washington, D.C. Now lined up at attention along the side. Here is the dock awaiting Lindbergh. Lindbergh is coming down as the gangplank, walking slowly, his hat in his hand, quietly, dignified, a darn nice boy.
That was Graham McNamee at Lindbergh's reception in Washington in 1927. And now for one of the very greatest stars of the period, a young fellow with a ukulele. His name was Cliff Edwards, but we called him Ukulele Ike.
In old Savannah, I said Savannah, the weather there is nice and warm, the climate of the southern brand. But here's one thing I can't understand. They've got a gal there, a pretty gal there, who's colder than an Arctic storm. She's got a heart just like a stone. Even Iceman let her alone.
Well, those are just a few of my memories. And as Captain Andy used to say, that was only the beginning, friends. Only the beginning. What do you say, Bob and Ray?
Yes, that was only the beginning, Pat. Only the beginning.
That's right, Bob. And after that came a lot of tunes that kids like us remember, along with our nursery rhymes.
Tasty yeast is tempting to your appetite. Creamy, wholesome candy. Try a luscious bite. Vitamins are hiding in this candy bar. Pep, vim, and vigor linger where they are. Children like this lovely, creamy food delight. Let them eat it daily, every morning, noon, and night. You will see them growing stronger every day. Taking yeast is dandy, handy candy way.
Those were the original Tasty Yeast Jesters singing one of radio's first commercial jingles. How about another one, boys?
Hello, hello. The RKO is sending out this message so the world will know. From Maine to California and up to Montreal, down to dear old New Orleans, you'll hear our friendly call.
the biggest stars from here to Mars will brighten up your radio. On Tuesday night when tuning in, remember we are crooning in the voice of the RKO.
Boy, that certainly does turn back the years, doesn't it?
Yeah, and just to think it all began with one little old commercial announcement on WNBC just 30 years ago.
Well, advertising certainly has made a big change in American life.
Yes, sir. Way back before that first commercial, people lived their lives according to fiction stories, popular novels, that sort of thing.
For instance, boys patterned their lives after Frank Merriwell, Tim the Bootblack, Phil the Fiddler.
Girls lived the way girls did in Little Women, Black Beauty, the Motor Girls in Arizona.
But today, people live according to advertisements. Advertisements from newspapers and magazines, radio and television.
And to illustrate this, we present a documentary drama entitled Albert in Adland, or Albert Armstrong, the All-American Copy Boy.
We first meet Albert at the age of 2 months, sitting erect in his crib, studying the Good Housekeeping seal of approval.
Cool. Cool. Poor me. All covered with this nasty, prickly heat. If I could only tell Mummy about Bartlett's baby bomb. Oh, boy, I'd be a Bartlett's bomb baby.
We next meet Albert when he's 6 years old. His father and mother are worried, but they are talking over the problem sensibly and calmly, the way people do in a full-color ad in the Saturday Evening Post.
Father, I'm so worried about Albert. He doesn't jump and run and play like the other boys, and he's so skinny and nervous and underweight, and all he does is mope around the house all day reading Dostoevsky and won't even eat his Swiss chard.
Mother, may I say what's in my heart?
Please do, Father. You are so wise.
Why don't we try C23 vegetable juice cocktail? C23 contains the juice of Swiss chard, turnips, parsnips, kale, rutabaga, and 18 other horrible vegetables. It'll soon bring the paste back to his pasty little cheeks. So they do. In no time at all, Albert is running and jumping and playing and snitching bicycles from the school rack.
Instead of being nervous and underweight, he's a fat slob.
And then, when he grew older, he met Althea. Many a happy afternoon they spent at the beach, smearing each other with gummo suntan lotion. And finally, one lovely night, Althea and Albert danced on the moonlit veranda at the country club.
Gee, Althea, darling, are you happy?
Of course I'm happy, Albert. And not only am I happy, but my pores are happy. That's because I use Milk-Bath complexion soap.
Clever girl, Althea.
Oh, Albert, darling. When did you first know that you loved me?
The moment I saw your Squeeze-O toothpaste smile. Squeeze-O is the only toothpaste that makes a girl's teeth shine in the dark. It contains phosphorus.
Yes, they were so happy. But then, as lovers will, they quarreled.
Why can't you smoke aristocrat cigarettes like the smart set do, you crumb?
Ah, your dresses are never color bright. No wonder the guys down at the pool hall make wisecracks all the time.
But Albert went to see his friendly dentist. And fortunately, Althea had some pretty unkind friends who didn't mind telling her. And so they were married.
Althea was Lux Lovely as she clutched him with one hand and held her national silver plate under her arm. They were deliriously happy in their own little home. Night after night, they tested wax papers together.
This is a very popular pastime among young married couples in Adland, testing wax papers to see which keeps bread tasty fresh longer.
Yes, married life in Adland was an endless round of gaiety.
However, middle-age retirement at 55 came at last. Albert and Althea moved into the personal security retirement stage of life.
And we find Albert dressed in a fishing outfit as Althea is puttering in the garden.
Now, in those ads, you'll remember, the gray-haired husband is always going fishing, and his wife, wearing eyeglasses, is always puttering in the garden.
Are you going fishing, Albert?
I gotta help you. We gotta have something to eat.
Well, I hope you catch something. I'm getting awfully tired of eating the roots in this old garden.
Sometimes I'm almost sorry we took out that age 55 personal retirement plan. I'd rather have some money instead of that hoe they gave you and this fishing rod they gave me. I should have read the small print at the end of the contract.
But have no fear. Even if they do starve to death, this couple in Adland need not worry. For the Slumber Glen pay-as-you-go memorial plan gives them peace of mind as they face the sunset.
Well, we sort of make it our business on the air to kid advertising and commercials, but the fact remains that none of the programs we've been talking about tonight would be on the air if it weren't for advertisers and sponsors.
Including Bob and Ray.
And here's the man who can tell you about that situation a lot better than we can, Mr. Charles Barry, Vice President in charge of radio and television programming for the National Broadcasting Company.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Ray. In radio,
We're usually too busy looking toward the future to think about the past. But now and then, there's a time to stop to think about what has been accomplished and of what we hope to do. When the first radio commercial was broadcast over station WNBC 30 years ago, it opened up new opportunities. The years that followed were filled with a spirit of adventure and accomplishment. New programs became American institutions, and new stars became the friends of an entire nation. Those years are filled with bright memories for those who planned and took part in the programs, and for those who listened to them. We recall some of those memories tonight. But tonight, we're looking forward with determination to fulfill the hopes of those radio pioneers who had such brave dreams only a few years ago. Through the will of the American people, a system of broadcasting was devised in which radio could bring everyone the finest in entertainment, news coverage, and public service programs. That system, supported by advertising, has made billions of dollars worth of radio service available to every home without cost. As General David Sarnoff has said, the richest person cannot buy for himself what the poorest gets free by radio. We're glad that WEAF, now WNBC, the key station of the National Broadcasting Company, has played such an important part in the development of radio broadcasting. And through our programs, we have had the happy privilege of visiting you in your home through the many years. We hope most sincerely that we will deserve your friendship in the years to come. Thank you very much.
That was Charles Barry, Vice President in charge of radio and television programming for the National Broadcasting Company. And this is Bob Elliott saying, right if you get work.
Ray Goulding saying, hang by your thumb.
This has been the Billion Dollar Show, a special recorded and transcribed program on the 30th anniversary of the first radio commercial. Today, radio sponsors bring you $1 billion worth of entertainment each year. This program was produced and directed by George Wallach and written by Jack C. Wilson. This is Arthur Gary speaking.